You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the lesser-known stories of World War II was the occupation of the Channel Islands. These small islands just off the coast of Normandy in France are in fact British-held islands and were in fact the only English territories to be occupied during the war. Now in the last 10 to 20 years, there have been a number of documentaries, films, books, and television programs about this occupation. For screenwriter Jenny LeCote, it's been a personal story and one she's been writing about the past few years. The Channel Islander native has told the story of her great aunt and uncle in her 2017 film, Another Mother's Son, on how they sheltered a Russian slave laborer and were involved in resistance activities. That film has just been released in the U.S. on Amazon Prime. Her new novel, also just released in the United States, tells another true story in a fictionalized way. The Girl from the Channel Islands tells the story of Hedy Birchow, an Austrian Jew who escaped the Nazi Anschluss there only to find herself in danger again when the islands were occupied. For a time, she hid in plain sight as an interpreter for the Germans, before faking a suicide and being hidden herself by Dorothea LeBrock, another islander that sheltered her. In the meantime, she fell in love with a German officer who brought food to them and eventually married him after the war. Jenny LeCote has written for television and film, most notably The EastEnders and The Catherine Tate Show on British television, and The Girl from the Channel Islands is her first novel. Jenny LeCote, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This novel is your second writing project that involves using a true story of the German occupation of the Channel Islands during World War II as a basis for storytelling. You're a native-born Channel Islander. What has inspired you to tell these stories now?
Okay, well, I am a native-born Channel Islander. A lot of people, I think, don't even really know where they are. They're a series of tiny islands just off the French coast, but they're part of the British Isles. And as you say, they were occupied by the Nazis during the war, the only British territory that was. And that part of history is not particularly well known. Even in Britain, it's not particularly well known in terms of the detail of what happened and the way that people survived. But a story that I grew up with was that my family had been involved in what you might loosely call resistance activity, in that they, one grandfather made crystal radio sets because they weren't allowed to have radios. And my other, on the other side of the family, my mum's side of the family, they harbored two Russian slave workers. And a number of years ago, I decided that it was about time somebody wrote the story up. So I wrote a film script, which was made into a film called Another Mother's Son, which, funnily enough, is out in the States at the moment on Amazon Prime. And that's about my great aunt Louisa and basically how she kept this Russian slave worker alive at a very high cost to herself. So, yeah, it's a history I've been personally involved with for quite a long time.
So that story came first, which obviously this was a family story that you knew about. Mm-hmm. How did you stumble upon the story of Hedwig Birchow Goldenberg? I believe that's her full name. You refer to her as Hedy Birchow in the story, in the novel. Was this another story that was a family story, or was this something you only learned about later?
No, this was part of Channel Island history now, but it was a story that came to more public attention a few years ago when Dorothea, who's one of the characters in the book and was a real person, was awarded a posthumous Yad Vashem Award for her courage and bravery in taking Hedy in during those years. And that's when the story sort of became a news item, went out all over the world. And I thought, this is such an amazing story that it really needs to be written. Unfortunately, not that much is known. The bare facts of the story were known, but how the real people actually came to meet, how they knew each other, and what the relationships were between them, except for the bits that we know, had to be fictionalized because nobody's left to know the truth about.
Yeah, there's really just a few little facts, but even those few little facts become sort of the building blocks of a good novel, right?
Yeah, I mean, we do know some things, and like what I call the planks of the story are all true. So we know that Hedy did arrive in Jersey, having fled the Angelus. She arrived there in 1938, presuming, I guess, that she was safe because it was off the coast of France. It was a long way from, you know, where the Nazis were at that point. But obviously, by May of 1940, she probably felt a lot less secure. And at the end of June, the Nazis invaded the islands. And as a Jewish woman, she was particularly vulnerable to that. But it is this extraordinary story that we know she did end up working for the Germans and using that situation to her advantage. And then when she had to go into hiding, we know that it was Dorothea who took her in and hid her at great personal risk. And we also know that she had a relationship with this officer named Kurt. And that in itself is such an extraordinary Romeo and Juliet love story that, you know, it sort of adds an extraordinary dimension to the whole thing.
It's interesting, in the very first chapter you use one of the few primary documents that is known about her, and that is when she has to register. After the Germans come in, anyone with a Jew would have to come in and register, and you include that scene right at the very beginning of the book, and apparently that is one of the documents we know about her because the British official, who was still working in his job, took meticulous notes about her.
That's right. That's right. And I know I've seen copies of that document. It was extraordinary. And you look back and you do wonder how on earth that happened. We know that she went along and lied and said that she wasn't Jewish, obviously to protect herself. And we know that the aliens officer in Jersey, even though there was some doubt about her ancestry, still marked her down as Jewish. And, of course, there was a lot of stories like that during the occupation. And in hindsight, you look back and think, why did they do that? But, of course, a lot of people were very frightened. They also didn't know what the implications were going to be and were choosing to look on the bright side. So, yeah, we do know that she was registered against her will as Jewish. And, of course, that put her in a very dangerous position, even compared to the rest of the population.
Now, you told us a little bit about the Channel Islands at the beginning, but did most of the Channel Islanders, I know there was some evacuations prior to the Germans landing there after they conquered France, probably within the month they came to the Channel Islands. But was there a feeling among the islanders that they were sort of outside of this conflict, or did they feel very much part of the British Empire and were sort of in the war effort?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that because during the First World War, they had remained relatively unaffected, I think they thought this one was going to be the same. I think that by the time it got to April and May and they saw the speed of the Nazi advance across France, I think they were starting to get very frightened then. And, of course, Britain effectively pulled out their military protection of the islands because they knew that they weren't going to be able to defend them. And I think one of the most frightening things for the islanders at, I think it was the beginning of, or middle of May 1940, was to see all the British troops basically getting on their boats and planes and leaving them to it. Mm. So when the Germans arrived, they were utterly defenseless. And I don't think any of them up to that point had expected that this would happen. But it was, many of them did actually evacuate in those last few days, but there was terrible confusion about what boats were available and who was going to pay for it. My grandmother actually was one of the people who stayed, but she was one of the people who almost went on one of the last boats. Hmm. But she knew she was going to be separated from her husband, my grandfather. And she had three kids under the age of five and was too scared to get on that defenseless boat and go across the English Channel, not knowing where she was going to end up. So they ended up staying for the whole occupation.
And that occupation, you said it wasn't really well known even in Britain. There's been a spate of films and books about this occupation finally in the last 20 years. Why was this story relatively unknown, do you suppose?
Well, there was a series of different narratives about the occupation over many decades. The first narrative, which was encouraged by the British government and to some extent by the Jersey government as well, was that it hadn't been too bad and there was nothing to see and everyone behaved very well. And it really was best forgotten. And I also think there was a lot of people who'd lived through it who really wanted to forget it because it had been a deeply traumatic experience. And then in the 90s, things changed. There were some other books written and a new narrative developed, which was that the islanders had suffered a great deal, but that many of them had collaborated and behaved atrociously and worked with the Germans and the trade people. Of course, neither of those narratives is really 100% true. Like any occupied territory, there are people who behave very courageously and there are people who behave very atrociously. and that's exactly what happened there. There were people who were truly brave. I'm glad to say that my family largely comes into that category. And there were others who sadly took advantage of the situation for money or for their own benefit. So it was a very divisive time. Also, I think there were probably documents that were released later on. Certainly the story of Hedy didn't really become public until sort of the 90s, and as I say, became much more well known in the last few years. So sometimes it just takes a while for these stories to emerge, I think.
And Hedy's an excellent example of how you could be in great danger from this occupation and yet at the same time sort of reviled by the population because of the steps she had to take to stay safe. She actually ended up working for the Germans as an interpreter and had a relationship with a German officer. If you were a native-born Jerseyite or a Channel Islander, a woman would have been known by a very derogatory name for being in that sort of situation. So it couldn't have been very easy for her.
Nobody really knows, obviously, the emotional journey that those people went through during that time. But the narrative that I've taken in the story is that she would have felt enormous guilt because coming from Austria, she would have been aware of what the Nazis were doing and the role that they played against Jews. And I think the fact that she fell in love with a German must have been very, very conflicting and difficult for her. And that was one of the things which drew me to the story, because those are the relationships that, you know, that do make good stories.
My guest today is Jenny Lakota. She's a British and television and film writer, and her first novel is out. It's titled The Girl from the Channel Islands, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. It's an interesting book that tells a story that has only become popular in film and television in just the last few years, and there have been a number of projects, your own film, Another Mother's Son, the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society just a couple of years ago. So this story is getting out there about the occupation. As I understand it, the occupation was fairly mild to begin with, but as the war continued, it got more and more brutal. In fact, there were forced labor camps on the island. I think I saw a documentary a few years ago in which they uncovered these forced labor camps that many of the citizens were forced to work at, especially the people who had taken refuge in the Channel Islands, people like Hedy.
Well, that's right. The forced labor camps were basically, this was exactly the people that my family helped to shelter during that time. It was a lot of Russians. They had a lot of Eastern Europeans. They had some Spaniards. And these were people they'd collected as slave labor to build the fortifications, because Hitler was obsessed with the Channel Islands, keeping them because they were a British territory, and he felt they were going to be the point at which he could attack the rest of the British Isles and use it as a base. It was also a huge jewel in the crown for him in terms of prestige. So he fortified the islands enormously and changed the landscape forever. I grew up, playing around anti-tank walls and German bunkers, which were there as a kid, which I didn't even really fully get the significance of until much later. But yeah, these people were brought over to build these fortifications and treated abysmally. Many of them were Slavic and were therefore, regarded as less than human by the Nazis. And they were worked to death and starved. It was atrocious. And a few of them managed to escape. And that's why people like my great aunt and family took them into their homes, because they felt desperately sorry for them. But of course, these people were trapped on the island and couldn't get away.
As the occupation continued, it got more brutal. You mentioned your grandfather built crystal sets. That's because all the radios were confiscated. And eventually, I think the last winter of the war was a time of huge privation. There was not nearly enough to eat. And this is also plays a role in the book as well, because Dorothea, who is the friend that takes Hetty in, you know, there's not enough to eat to begin with, and any sort of overconsumption of food arouses suspicion. So she was taking enormous risks.
That's right. And you're absolutely right. The war started with, you know, a degree of fear and brutality, but it got much worse as time went on. And that last year, after the D-Day landings, when the islands were completely cut off from France and from Britain, and they had no supplies coming in. And there was a period in the second half of 1944, a number of people did die of starvation, and many, many more would have done had it not been for the Red Cross ship that finally turned up around Christmas. So to take somebody into your home and to take the responsibility of feeding them when, you know, you had barely had enough to survive on your own rations was an incredibly brave and selfless thing to do. There were very few cats and dogs left on the island by 1945. That's certainly true.
You said we know a little bit of Hetty's story, and you had, you know, it becomes the fodder for fiction in your book, The Girl from the Channel Islands, but what is known of the basic points of the story? Did she actually work as an interpreter for a couple of years?
Yeah, she did. We know that she worked for the Germans. We don't know exactly under what circumstances she got that job, but she did start work for them. And she worked for them. And as is in the book, I don't want to spoil too much of the story, but she did use that situation to her advantage to help the local medical population. To help the local hospital and doctors. So that's a very important part of the story. And that, of course, put her at enormous risk again, as if, you know, being Jewish on the island wasn't enough. She put herself even greater risk. But I suppose the extraordinary story, really, is that had it not been for her relationship with this German officer, she may not have survived at all, because she and Dorothea may have starved. We know that Kurt visited the house and that he brought them food. If you go to Jersey now, there is a blue plaque outside the house which gives the name of both Hetty and Dorothea, and praises Dorothea for her enormous courage and the fact that she saved Hetty's life. So, yeah, it's become quite a significant part of Channel Island history. And those are kind of the foundations of the story that we know to be true.
I am going to apologize for giving this away, but it's such beautiful writing. You know, one of the things she did, as you mentioned, she was helping out the doctors on the island by stealing ration coupons so they could travel around the islands. And she said it was her mitzvah for working with the Germans.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that it's so interesting. There are so many stories like that that people pointed fingers after the war and said, oh, you collaborated with the Germans or you worked with the Germans. And then afterwards, you discover that those people were actually using that situation to work against them. But of course, they had to do that secretly. You couldn't trust anyone, or the Germans had spies everywhere. You didn't know what was going to get reported. So people had to be very careful about what information they shared. And everything was on a need-to-know basis. So Hetty would have kept it very quiet that she was stealing petrol coupons, which of course were enormously valuable because petrol was heavily rationed, as was everything else. Yeah, it was extraordinary courage. Yeah.
Now, eventually, she had to quit working for the Germans, and she actually staged, in the book, she stages her suicide about 2 years into the war, 3 years into the war. Was that true?
That's exactly what she did. She put a pile of clothes on the beach and left a note and hoped that would be the end of it. But of course, the Germans were suspicious that this was not the case. And she remained basically hiding in plain sight for the rest of the war in certain respects, because she couldn't really leave the house. She was sort of kind of under a house arrest because it was so dangerous for her to go out. It's possible that they may have gone out looking for food and stuff like that, but it would have been a very claustrophobic existence, because once she had faked this suicide, of course, you know, her face couldn't be seen again.
Right. Now, this was not implausible at the time, because one of the true stories of the occupation was that about that time of the war, all of a sudden, many of the Channel Islanders did commit suicide under the stress of the situation of occupation.
There were a number of suicides. I don't think a high amount, but obviously there are some people who find themselves under appalling circumstances. Certainly there were people, when threatened with deportation, felt that they couldn't stand the thought of that because they didn't know where they were going to be sent. There was a whole bunch of islanders who were deported in 1942 when Hitler decreed that anyone who had English, who was born in England or had English parentage had to be deported. And some people were unable to face that. Interestingly, there was a number of German soldiers also who committed suicide when they were told that they were going to leave Jersey and being sent to the Eastern Front. So it was a grim period of history for sure.
My guest today is Jenny Lecote. She's a British television and film writer. Her first novel is out, titled The Girl from the Channel Islands. It's based on the true story of Hedy Bertschou, who was an Austrian Jew who fled to the Channel Islands after the Anschluss in Vienna in Austria, and then was there when the Channel Islands were occupied by the Nazis during World War II. This is her second project that involves the story of the Channel Islands occupation. These islands are just off the coast of Normandy, to the west of Normandy, of little military significance, but the Germans did occupy it for the duration of the war. And that earlier project was Another Mother's Son, a 2017 film, which told the story of Louisa Gould, who was actually an ancestor, correct?
That's right. She was my great aunt. She was the sister of my grandpa.
And of course, in your novel, Dorothea escapes detection and, in fact, is a hero of Yad Vashem today. But for Louisa, it did not turn out as well. She ended up going to Germany into a concentration camp. It did not survive.
Yeah, that's right. It's a story that I grew up with, and I was always aware of it. I suppose it's something that the adults didn't discuss too much around the children in those days, but I was always aware of what had happened. But when you're young, it's difficult to get the full import of stories like that in your family. And it's only when I got a little older, I got into my 30s, and there would be these documentaries every time there was an anniversary. Mm. And I would see these pictures of my family coming up in these documentaries and thinking, this is actually a pretty big deal. And the fact that so little has been written about it. You know, she appeared in a few history books. She appeared in these documentaries. But I think there's a great quote that said George Bernard Shaw, I think, who said that it's only through fiction that facts can become instructive. And I think sometimes it's a story can have more impact if it's fictionalized. And I wanted to bring that story to life for people. I wanted people to know that it was not a one-sided. It was not a one-sided narrative in the occupation years. There were people who did bad things, many people who simply got on with their life and kept their head down, and there were other people who did really extraordinary and brave things. And I'm very proud that, you know, my family came into that category.
Yeah. Was the experience of doing the film Another Mother's Son helpful in writing this first novel? Because there you had a certain set of facts that you knew very well to fictionalize the story. This time you have perhaps less to go on.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, because I think part of the reason I wanted to try to write a novel of the Hedy story is that I had so many things that I couldn't get into the original film, so much background history, that, of course, in a 90-100-page film script, there's lots of stuff that just ends up going in the bin because there's no room for it. And I thought there was so much else that I wanted to say and that you have space for in a book. And of course, although Hedy's story is the centerpiece of the book, but what I was really interested in writing about as well was to tell the story of the occupation from the perspective of people who suffered through it. and to try and give some sense of, not that I experienced it myself, of course, but what it must have been like. Because my parents grew up during that time and told me stories about it. And, you know, it stays with you. It's something that resonates and you feel is worth a visit.
Give us a sense of something that shows up in the novel that is like that, that sort of gives us a sense of what it was like to live through that period.
Well, I think the issue you brought up earlier of food, for example, I mean, everyone was just starving the whole time until the Red Cross parcels started coming in that a matter of months before the end of the war. There was a whole period when it was a struggle for the family every single day to put food on the table. And I think of what, you know, my father, for example, grew up as he was sort of 5 to 10 years old when this was going on. And he grew up in a house where his father was making crystal radio sets, although I don't know that he would have known that. My grandmother told me that when the soldiers used to come around and search the house, they would stick the crystal radio sets under the mattress of the baby's cot. And she would walk out and, you know, go for a walk with the baby to hide these illegal sets, because, of course, if they had been caught, they would have been sent to prison and probably deported as well. So there's lots of stories like that. And just, you know, the sheer stress of trying to find enough food to put on the table for your kids every day was extraordinary. And that's something that I really wanted to I really wanted to get a sense of that into the book.
It's interesting. The very opening part of the book is Hetty on the beach and watching a plane appear, and then several planes, and hearing of a bombing of the harbor. And it's interesting that, you know, given that the fact that, you know, probably the overwhelming reminiscences of being hungry, what was bombed was a shipment of food.
Well, that's right, because apparently what had happened was that when the British pulled out of the islands and said, "I'm afraid we can't defend you," and retreated, they did not inform the German authorities that they had done that, because they thought it would be bad for morale. So as far as the Germans were concerned, the islands were still defended by the British, and that's why they went in and bombed them. And the trucks that were at the side of the harbour, which were potatoes and tomatoes waiting to go out for export, they took to be military trucks, and that's why they strafed them and dropped bombs in the harbour, because they thought they were attacking a defended position. But in fact, they were these tiny little islands that, I mean, people barely had a shotgun and a knife between them, and they had nothing in the defence of this, you know, enormous German army coming over the Channel.
It's a really interesting book. The name of the book is The Girl from the Channel Islands. Jenny, thanks so much for your time today. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Jenny Lacote is a British television and film writer. Her first novel is titled The Girl from the Channel Islands, which is based on a true story during the German occupation of the Channel Islands during World War II. Her 2017 film, Another Mother's Son, is also based on a true story of her family from that time and has just been released on Amazon Prime. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.